Today's podcast is brought to you by PNC, supporting early education, racial and social justice, and economic development through programming within the communities we serve. Greetings. Welcome to episode 7 of the Kaleidoscope Podcast. I'm your host, Nichols DeCorville. As we've dedicated time to providing a platform for those that need a louder voice, this episode will focus on the works published within our magazine. Kaleidoscope, beginning in 1979, pioneered the exploration of the experience of disability through the lens of literature and fine arts. Fiction, personal essays, poetry, articles, book reviews, and various artistic media including two-dimensional art, three-dimensional art, drama, theater, and dance are featured in the pages of various issues. In 2022, we began a podcast to increase accessibility and expand our reach. This award-winning publication expresses the experience of disability from a variety of perspectives including individuals, families, friends, caregivers, healthcare professionals, and educators, among others. The material selected for Kaleidoscope challenges stereotypical, patronizing, and sentimental attitudes about disabilities. The magazine is published by United Disability Services located in Akron, Ohio. Our mission is to provide and support life-enriching options through person-centered programs and advocacy. Issues of Kaleidoscope can be downloaded at no cost by visiting us at kaleidoscopeonline.org. For this episode, we're concluding our readings of issue 88. Last episode, we explored contributions from our poets and authors, and we will be continuing to explore the art of living throughout this episode as well. In life, there's often chances to reflect on your actions and review the journey that has made you, you. Where you have come from, where you are going, and where you're at now are all important things to consider as you listen to the following contributions. Remember that you can listen to part one of this episode on all of your favorite streaming services. First, we have Metamorphosis by Ellen Zhang. Within this poem, Zhang explores how she navigated her mother's lupus diagnosis, exploring this journey throughout her life. Navigating the poem, the speaker longs for answers. As you listen, consider the questions you would have in this situation.
Metamorphosis, Ellen Zhang. When my mother is diagnosed with lupus, she sank down in relief. Finally, her prayers had been answered to form more questions than answers, support in the shape of textbooks and doctor appointments looming on our dining room counter wall calendars. As children, we didn't know any better and traced rashes on her face. She said butterflies, so we pictured monarch ones coming and returning more frequently than migration season. We didn't question when she no longer took us to the park, grocery store, picked us up after school. Only later did we realize her aching joints, her body attacking herself, pain she carried throughout the days. Later, she told us that our naivety was her protection, that she tucked into her pillowcase after afternoon naps, folded into her tired evenings, soothing her when awakened from sharpening discomfort. We didn't really understand how serious it was until we were teenagers, spending the holidays in the hospital, where we learned about bacteremia, steroids, autoimmune conditions. Your body was attacking itself as you closed yourself in words. Your disease is all uncertainty and fluttering curiosity. Now, I am the one wearing the white coat, answering prayers, inviting questions. Every patient has your face. Still, more questions than answers linger through the days. So far, I have migrated with my wings fluttering, and you are the warmth to which I return.
Coming up next, we have Darcy in The Hook, Line, and Sinker by Danielle Kerkorian. Throughout this fictional work, we follow Darcy as she confronts her condition with obsessive-compulsive disorder. This story originally found itself in the fall issue of Open Minds Quarterly, and we're proud to share it again with you now.
Darcy and The Hook, Line, and Sinker, written by Danielle Kerkorian. Darcy, you're eating fish on a Thursday. You're not supposed to be eating fish on a Thursday. Remember what happened last time you ate fish on a Thursday? You got sick. Stop now. It's good fish this time, but it's Thursday, a bad day to eat fish. Stop eating. Darcy paused and looked at her friend Bree. I'll be right back. Bree nodded and Darcy left, looking for the bathroom. Darcy, you ate fish today. You're gonna get sick, and not only that, but something bad will happen too. She nearly crashed into the door when she found the bathroom. Once she was inside, Darcy ran to the nearest stall and was about to get in when the voice returned. Not that stall. That one is the first stall. Remember, one isn't a good number. Try the second stall. Darcy walked to the second stall in the row, pushed open the door, and slammed it behind her once she was inside the white cubicle. She locked the door and rested her forehead against it. Darcy, why is your forehead on the dirty door? Get it off. She obeyed and took shallow breaths. Breathe. But instead of inhaling a breath, she started crying. Warm, salty tears started escaping down her face, ready to fall to the floor and splatter. They were reminders of how weak she was. Damn it, she said, pounding her fist against the door of the stall. She wouldn't be feeling this anxious if she told her friend that she wasn't craving fish today. But that would be a lie. She did perk up when her friend asked if she wanted to go to the fish grill with her. It sounded like something good to eat. Plus, she could be doing some exposure therapy by facing her fear. She couldn't limit herself. Darcy was already so limited, but this was her own fault. She should have known she couldn't handle this. When you get home, Darcy, you have to shower. Then maybe you won't get sick and you won't be dirty. Again, the fear of being dirty or contaminated. The demon in her mind always circled back to that main fear and the shower compulsion. Darcy had been obeying these fearful commands ever since she started having anxiety problems when she was small. She was a fish. A helpless fish like the one she'd just been consuming. She was lost and always afraid of being eaten. But then a shiny piece of something that disguised itself as relief would descend into her ocean, beckoning her, calling her with promises of a fearless future and the smell of liberation. Once she grabbed onto that shiny something, its true colors would show and it would be too late. That piece of relief was attached to a silver sharp hook that would latch into her fishy flesh and carry her up into the cold air where she couldn't breathe. Everything came with a price, even relief. There were always strings attached, and for Darcy, those strings came with silver sharp hooks that would make her bleed. She was tired of bleeding. She wanted armor. She wanted a sword or weapon. If she was a fish, then why couldn't she be a swordfish? That way she would have some chance of keeping herself safe and uncut. Footsteps echoed in the bathroom, bringing Darcy out of her thoughts. She held her breath and waited, but it was just another woman needing to use the bathroom for her own relief. Darcy unlocked her bathroom stall door and walked out, looking at herself in the mirror. Her face was stained with tears. She needed to clean herself up. Darcy started to wash her hands so she could wipe her face, but there was that catch. She had to wash her hands for 2 minutes or else it wouldn't be done properly. More than that, she had to think of safe and clean thoughts at the same time. It was the merry-go-round from hell her mind always rode, the scary-go-round. But no, she didn't have to ride the scary-go-round. Not anymore. Actually, not ever. Darcy rinsed her hands of the soap, grabbed a paper towel, and wiped her face. She was about to walk out the door when the anxiety, the one she usually felt when she disobeyed the demon, bubbled up. Darcy, go back and wash your hands for 2 minutes. Then something bad won't happen. Clenching her teeth together and her hands into fists, Darcy had a choice to make. A quick one before the woman in the stall came out to find her staring at the bathroom door. She could break free a bit and tell the demon that she had the power, or she could give the demon more power. Anxiety bubbled more. Still trying to figure out what to do, Darcy heard the flush of a toilet. Her time was up. She needed relief. Darcy walked back to the sink. Hook, Line, and Sinker. The end. This short story was inspired by my own struggles with anxiety and OCD. I hope readers will come to understand how complex OCD is and the distress it causes to the person who is struggling with the disorder. But I also hope readers will realize that there is hope and that OCD doesn't have to rule your life. You can have courage and take heart knowing that there is power within you to overcome OCD and to live freely. Thank you so much for listening and for reading.
For some, navigating the static in your head can feel like browsing the internet or channel surfing. Too much noise, and it's easy for things to get lost. While it can be difficult, finding an outlet to minimize the static can have a positive impact on your health. Now, we're following these themes through M.E.D. Wells's The Voices in His Head, a creative nonfiction story wherein the author faces challenges with their teenager confronting his schizophrenia.
The Voices in His Head by M.E.D. Wells. Mom, can I have a PRN med, please? 16-year-old Max asked me. He rubbed the sides of his head. They won't stop coming. I handed him one of the pills he took a few times a week when the voices in his head got too loud, and then guided him to the living room to give the medication time to work. Moments later, a high-pitched screech came as Max ran down the hall towards the outside kitchen door. I slipped in front of him. When Max is in distress, his first instinct is to flee. I knew that if he were to go into the street, not only could he get hit by a car, but as a black teenager, there could be a violent reaction from the neighbors or the police. Max's dad called 911. Max melted to the floor and writhed. They keep coming. I wanted to talk to him, but when the voices in his head are loud, they are all he can hear. They tell Max to hurt himself and other people. To kill. One of the most common symptoms of schizophrenia is hallucinations. Some people with schizophrenia have visual hallucinations, meaning that they see things that aren't really there. Others have auditory, hearing things that aren't there, or tactile, feeling things that aren't really happening. Although Max usually has auditory and visual hallucinations, he occasionally gets tactile as well. This was one of those times. Max's screams sawed through the walls. They went into the yard and pushed their way into the empty street that awaited the ambulance that held the paramedics who would medicate Max. Make the voices go away. At least make them stop screaming. When you adopt a child, you don't expect him to come home with other people inside of his head. He smiles and cries and laughs just like other babies do. Something happens while he grows, though. His imaginary friends get angry. They get mean. They take over. They won't stop coming. Max punched his head and scratched his face. I grabbed his hand. He hit me. Max's dad was on the phone. With each word Max screeched, the dogs howled. The screaming, the talking, and the howling reverberated throughout the house, bounced off the walls, and pierced my ears. I couldn't think. They won't stop coming. The paramedics backed the ambulance into the driveway. 10 seconds, 50 seconds, a minute and a half. Why the hell aren't they getting out? They won't stop coming. In the doorway, a police officer appeared. His night blue uniform was perfectly pressed and his gun hung from his belt. The scene would have made Max nervous had he been alert. The last time the cops came, the voices told him to attack even though he didn't want to. What's going on here? The officer asked. I yelled my answers because the dogs were howling and Max was screaming and my ears were searing with pain. Has this happened before? When your son is on the floor screaming for the voices in his head to shut up and the dogs are howling and screeching, because your son is yelling at the people in his head, the first thing you wonder is why the hell it matters if this has happened before. Even if it has happened before, it is happening now. You think to yourself, but don't say, because you know you need their help and you don't want to make them go any slower than they already are. They won't stop coming. The officer left. 7 minutes. 8. He returned with a paramedic. Then another one appeared with 2 more officers. They surrounded Max and yelled about what should be done. They won't stop coming. One of the paramedics came with a needle and a vial in his hand. He unwrapped the syringe and held the vial up to the light. I wanted to snatch it out of his hand and do it myself, make it go faster. They won't stop coming. They held Max down. Stuck him in the arm. 9 minutes. 11. They won't stop coming. Maybe he needs more, a paramedic said. Another nodded and pulled out another syringe. Unwrap. Draw out the liquid. They won't stop coming. He stabbed Max's thigh. We waited. 4 more minutes. 15. 19. They won't stop coming. He needs to go to the hospital, the paramedic told me. When your son is trying to get away from people that don't exist, people who want him dead, who want you dead, it quickly becomes apparent that your son needs to go to the hospital. You wonder, but again don't ask, why they haven't already strapped him on the gurney and put him in the ambulance. It's impossible to impart this information, though, when your son is screaming and your dogs are howling. The sounds stab at the back and the sides of your skull like a knife moving around, back and forth, side to side, in and out. They won't stop coming. One paramedic brought a flexible stretcher, like a reinforced max-length tarp with handles. Max kicked and swung at them. 4 men lifted Max and took him outside, where the 5th man waited with a gurney. Max flailed. They strapped him down. The staring eyes in the Bangor main emergency room made Max's screams louder. Before I got through security and into his room, they had given him a 3rd and 4th injection. I watched the crowd of people work over Max as he flailed under the weight of their hands. The doctor asked, "Who is Luke?" I thought his name was Max. His name is Max. But he just called himself Luke. My mind raced, then it dawned on me. Oh, his name is Max. Luke is the dominant voice in his head. The doctor nodded with recognition. Luke has never spoken to anyone other than Max before. The doctor moved rapidly through his questions. We may have to chemically sedate Max if these meds don't start working. I knew he meant it would chemically paralyze Max, make him unable to move. I nodded, giving permission for something I did not want for Max, but saw no other option. Max is such a weakling. It feels so good to be out, Luke spoke in a low register. Luke's voice was more sinister than Max's had ever been. I wanted to throw up. This was someone I did not recognize, and the thought crossed my mind that I might never see Max again. I wanted to show Luke what I thought about him taking over this almost grown man who knows how people might judge him even if it isn't true, as another black man on drugs. Luke's movements were reduced to small waves of squirming aggression. I want to kill you all, he screamed with an increasingly weak voice. I will never let Max out again. Just as suddenly as it started, he was asleep. The nurse drew blood, checking for drugs and chemical imbalances. Doctors want to believe parents when they say their child does not do drugs, but they prefer the surety of their machines over fragile parental psyches. No drugs. I tried to sleep in the hard metal chair. I paced the room. I tried to sleep again. For 14 hours, I wondered, when I saw his eyes again, who would be behind them. Mom, what happened? It was Max. I was sure. Those were his beautiful, loving eyes. Even though I was sure, I held back my tears. Maybe I wasn't really sure. Can I ever be sure? Author's note. For Max, living with schizophrenia is a daily effort to stay centered in reality. He rarely ever stops hearing the voices in his head, even with his medications. We talk about the voices as though they live on a spectrum. When his meds are working well, the voices are there, but they are quieter. He can concentrate better and have conversations with people without pausing to figure out which of the voices he hears are real. When his regular medications aren't enough, he has to take a little extra, something we call a PRN. It is at those times that Max is most distressed. It comes just before he loses all touch with reality. If we don't catch it in time, it's too late. He needs emergency department intervention. That is what I've described here. For him, the ever-present possibility of going to an emergency department means an ever-present possibility of going to a psychiatric hospital. It is a living hell. The medications help keep Max from medical emergencies, but hallucinations are a part of his world. He lives with it every minute of every day. Even when he sleeps, the most prominent voice in his head tells him to kill the ones he loves. Every night, he watches us die. Every night, he kills us. Thank you for listening. This is Emmy Wells.
If you need more information about childhood schizophrenia, please visit the Mayo Clinic's website at mayoclinic.org. You can visit the National Alliance on Mental Illness's website for more generalized information at nami.org. Next, we have Another Country by Connie Harold. Within this work of creative nonfiction, Harold explores the feelings and perspectives that arise from losing your vision, a story that many may find to be entirely too relatable.
Another Country by Connie Harold. This is another country. It is not labeled on any map. There are no road signs or directions. No clearly marked access ramp, roundabout, or entry. There is only a crooked, narrow lane leading to an empty, one-way street. This is an invisible country. This is a place of abrupt detours, of dead ends without warning. The curious glance stealthily in its direction, then hurriedly rumble pass. This is an impoverished country, the land of the immobilized, the inoperative, the crumpled, and the fallen. There is no returning passport or reprieve at this border. There is no able conveyance willing to cart one back. This is a deleterious country, a thieving thoroughfare pitted with rust and ruts and ruin. This is the place of the unwilling exile, the sudden outcast, the stranded sojourner careening to the curb without forewarning. This is another country, a place of lost landscapes and truncated horizons. I have landed in another country, disabled in America. As far back as memory would take me, my eyes had done strange things, mostly sudden flashes of intensely blinding light, or everything would lose its color and then return in a radioactive green haze. Sometimes my eyes would refuse to focus. I would be reading or drawing, and suddenly it was as if I was looking through a lens smeared with Vaseline, or blind spots would appear without warning and disappear just as fast. It seemed to happen in the dreaded humidity of summer, when the temperature stalled in the 90s, guaranteeing my body would be on the verge of collapse, as if it wanted to go on strike. Finally, I took a chance and told my mother. For once, she took my complaints seriously and made an appointment to see the eye doctor. I actually thought the optometrist might know what I was talking about. It would be the first of many mistakes I'd make trying to explain what was happening with my sight. I could barely see the cool brown doctor or his cool brown hands as he fiddled with his instruments. It was just a watery, tanned haze. He walked out of my line of sight as I swiped my eyes on my sleeve, and when he came back in front of me, he was frowning. Then he smiled the way adults do when they want you to stop making them feel uncomfortable. "There isn't any reason to cry," he said patiently, holding out a box of tissues. It took him a minute to realize I couldn't see it before he stuffed them into my hand. "I'm not crying." Dr. Ellis raised the examining chair so I was eye level with him. "Put your chin up here," he said, pointing to the black plastic headrest. "We're almost finished." He adjusted the knobs and swung the machine with the lens back over my face. "Tell me when you see the two lines come together." He moved close, looking deep into my eyes as if he was trying to decide about something. "Your mother tells me you're quite an artist. Didn't you win the art contest here at the hospital?" I was stunned. Who paid attention to stuff like that? "Yes, my picture was in the Free Press. And I'm going to be an artist, and I need to be able to see. So you've got to figure out what's wrong with me." The doctor's white coat floated back and forth in front of me like a ghost. The pain in my eyes was spreading to the top of my head as he leaned in close with a tiny flashlight. I jerked away. "We'll take a break for a minute," he said. The ceiling lights came on, and I quickly shut my eyes and covered them tightly with my arm. I thought I was going to throw up. The doctor turned off the lights, lifted my chin, and flashed the pinpoint light in my right eye again. I wanted to punch him. From close behind me, Mom thundered, "Stop fooling around! I have to get back to work!" Her Jean Nate body powder hung thickly in the air above me. "This is giving me a headache." "You are a headache," Mom bellowed as if she was ready to punch me. "If you don't stop complaining and cooperate." "I am cooperating. My eyes are just tired." I hesitated, thinking fast for some way to make the torturous exam finish quickly. I just wanted to go home and lie down and not get back up. "I don't think I really need new glasses," I said like I meant it. "So go blind then," she hollered and flung the examining room door open with a heavy thud. Tears were running down my face like Niagara Falls from eye strain until my blouse and training bra were soaked. I heard doors opening, doors closing, and the clicking of her high heels echoing down the hall. Dr. Ellis asked me again if it had happened before, and I shook my head. Maybe I should have told him about the time the colors shimmered so brightly and so beautifully I thought I was in heaven. Or about the time I ran into the wall in the school gym. But that had been different. I was dribbling the basketball toward the hoop when everything went blank, and a second later I was watching a sharp corner bearing down inches away from my face as my forehead slammed dead into it. I could have told him, but I didn't. I knew he wasn't going to believe me. Nobody ever did. "And you have light eyes. What color are they?" "They change." "God, not that. Sometimes they're blue or green or gray." I had a teacher in elementary school who would announce to the class whenever they changed colors, because even for a light-skinned Negro kid, it was pretty unusual. It set me apart the same way drawing and painting did, and not being able to see. They're very pretty, but it makes them more sensitive to the light. He patted me on the shoulder. "I can order a tint to put on your lenses that should help with the glare you've been experiencing," he said, trying to be reassuring. "I paint a little too. Landscapes. There's one hanging in the reception area. Let me know what you think." "You want to know what I think?" I think you're not telling me what's really going on. If this is glare, then I'm going to be wearing sunglasses at midnight. He chuckled. We'll order you a pair of sunglasses, too. And I knew as I stared up into his grandfatherly face, knew without asking what he wasn't going to answer. Am I going to go blind? It had been more than 4 decades since my first terrifying bout with blindness as a child, when I opened my eyes one December morning to the bleak discovery that I was completely and totally blind in my right eye. No light was getting through. I'd laid on the bed most of the previous night, afraid to close my eyes, focusing instead on the sweaty wrinkles in the cotton sheet, the intimate lamplight trembling across the fading pages of the thriller I was fighting to read. It was as if an electrical wire had gnawed at its own insulation, causing a short circuit in my optic nerve. The stealthy ambush was the latest manifestation of my newly disabling and newly diagnosed adversary, multiple sclerosis. This is an undiscovered country, an unexplored land, sans stars or moons or sky. Here night darkens quickly, light changes imperceptibly, an empty shadow rising beneath the sun. The chasm between my doctor and me was as deep and endless as the Grand Canyon on a foggy night. He asked me what I could see. I told him nothing. It was almost a lie. What I could see wasn't to be found on any of his eye charts. I compared it to the complete solar eclipse, whose shadow was then passing over the earth. Religious crowds had gathered throughout India to hail the phenomenon as a worshipful sign. As the whole world was obscured in dimmed celestial light, I held my breath and prayed in that moment. They were right. Things happen for a reason. Empires fall. The lights go out. You wake up one day and can't see. It makes you focus. It made me see. As much as I thought I knew about light, the reality of its form and not form was infinitely different from my previous experiences. Here was the missing path. I had seen and painted the intricacies of color since I was 4. And repeatedly experience light as a presence. That glowing expansion into infinite light was totally different from ordinary seeing. This, however, was something else again, an experience of light as darkness pulling inward instead of expanding out. Both black and white contain all the colors of the rainbow spectrum, and slowly I began to realize how much form and volume and depth were shaped by the perception of those sensations. For I could see and feel how people and tables and televisions radiated light, even if I could not receive it in a normal way through my right eye. It was reminiscent of swirls of water, a pattern of waviness that didn't quite extend to me, as if held back by an opaque barrier. Each day, the barrier became a bit thinner, less intrusive, but it was there. It would not lift, it would not fall, and each time I crashed into a bookcase or stumbled into a chair, I had to stop my thoughts from tumbling to the floor. I backed off from all the emotion and put aside all projections of what shape the future would take. I rounded up the pain, categorize its variations and manifestations, pushed them into the corner of my consciousness, and told my fears to shut up. And then I meditated as best as I could, let my body float away, and focused on what I was actually able to see. The body is a treacherous companion. I don't pay much attention to it anymore. I have learned to close my eyes to still my thoughts. I have learned to leave the body behind. Slowly, I mend all the flowers of my senses by concentrating deeply, intensely, on the sun that rises behind closed eyes. My sight has inched back through the mist, shifted the wavy grayness as it recedes, like the faint remains of a half note, reverberating through the air, or positive and negative space, twisting together in a work of art. What was once a diminished state is now a different state, aglow. The art critic John Berger once asked, "What is art but a way of seeing?" Perhaps seeing is the art. I close my eyes on another country, a land of truncated vistas, an endless terrain of night. My eyes open. I see a straight and narrow highway and watch as the undulating spherical whole moves from the center of my sight, from particle to wave, from matter to thought, from darkness to body to light.
Now, let's take a listen to Claire Ibarra's Borscht with a Cherry on Top. This story follows the protagonist as they schedule a date for a neighbor with mild Down syndrome. What's fascinating about this story is its ability to handle perspectives. Not only do you see the perspective of the young girl navigating her feelings with a crush, but you also experience how a mother may handle their child with a disability experiencing feelings and emotions for the first time. Let's listen.
Borscht with a Cherry on Top by Claire Ibarra. The apartment was draped with melancholy, and Margaret had let herself fall into a sullen mood. She sat propped by pillows on her bed, looking through a photo album. The knock at the door shook Margaret out of her slump. She forgot she was still wearing her nightgown when she answered the door. "Hello, neighbor," Margaret said as she gave Yvonne's shoulder a gentle pat. "Hello, I wanted to... Oh, are you ill?" Yvonne tilted her head as she examined Margaret from head to toe. Yvonne wasn't the kind of person to stay in her pajamas, especially past noon. "Heavens no, I'm just taking the day off. Would you like to come in?" Margaret offered while saying a little prayer that Yvonne would decline. "I have to get down to the store. Franklin is waiting. I want to ask you to check in on Sarah later. She's not herself." Yvonne spoke abruptly, always to the point. "Can she come here to my place?" "I'll tell her to come in an hour. Is that good?" Yvonne said with her accent, which made her sound decisive and tough for a 5'2" old lady. In her chunky gray sweater and wool skirt, Yvonne limped down the hallway and disappeared into the shadows. Margaret suddenly felt young. By the time Sarah rang the doorbell, clothes were scattered all over. Margaret led Sarah into the room, and before the girl had a chance to say a word, she was draped in scarves and jewelry, wearing high heels and a knit hat. Standing in front of the mirror, Margaret twirled her around and Sarah clapped her hands. "Can you do my makeup too?" Sarah asked gleefully. Sarah was 19 years old and had mild Down syndrome. Yvonne had never spoken to Margaret about Sarah's condition. Only once, Yvonne skirted the subject by saying that Sarah was born different. The term most people thought to use was special, but Yvonne didn't think that way. The whole notion of political correctness escaped her. Margaret had watched Sarah grow up. When she was little, Sarah sometimes visited their apartment to watch TV and eat cookies. Once in a while, Yvonne needed a spur-of-the-moment babysitter, and Margaret had been happy to oblige. "There now, let's have a look," Margaret said as she stood with Sarah in front of the mirror. "You look beautiful." The look didn't quite work with Sarah. It was too much makeup. She looked better without any at all, and the hat and scarf overpowered her. But Sarah grinned at herself and tilted her head, taken in by her own coquettish girlishness. I look beautiful, she imitated Margaret's inflections. Your mother told me you're not yourself these days. Is there something bothering you, Sarah? Staring at herself in awe, she replied, My mother treats me like a baby. Your mother cares about you very much. Sarah sat down on the bed and said, Did you know I have a boyfriend? Sarah suddenly got embarrassed and giggled into her hand. She did this to express most every emotion. Joy, nervousness, embarrassment, and relief were all denoted by giggling into her cupped hand. That's wonderful. Is he a nice boy? Margaret asked. Oh, he's very nice. He goes to my school. Suddenly, Sarah looked defeated. My mom and dad won't like that I have a boyfriend. Have you told them? No. Then how do you know they won't like it? Sarah looked up at the ceiling and thought for a moment. Margaret noticed how vulnerable Sarah was just then, and she wondered how she could help her. How would you like to have a part-time job, Sarah? Really? Would I get paid? It was Sarah's first day of work, and Margaret was surprised when she showed up at the door with her boyfriend, Darren. Margaret worried that Sarah had misunderstood and took her new job as merely a ruse to rendezvous with her lover. Then Margaret imagined the two requesting to borrow her bed for an hour, after which Sarah would tell her parents all about the errands she did for Miss Margaret. Instead, Sarah very shyly introduced Darren to Margaret. He was polite and shook Margaret's hand. They had strolled into the kitchen, and Margaret offered them each a seat at the dinette table. Once they were settled, Sarah and Darren sat at the table like they were at a restaurant waiting to be served. Margaret had the urge to give them menus. She regretted that she didn't have something to offer them, something that kids like. Darren, may I ask, how old are you? Margaret wasn't sure. He looked 12, but he could also be 25. I'm almost the same age as Sarah. Does that mean you're older or younger than Sarah? It means we're not the same age, but almost the same. Margaret suddenly realized that he was evading the question. I guess it's time for Sarah to get to work. I've made a list. Margaret went over the list carefully with Sarah, explaining that in the pharmacy, the clerk would help her find L'Oreal Medium Auburn No. 5 MB Optimized Fade Defying Hair Dye. The small canvas bag to drop off at the dry cleaners was uncomplicated. And for groceries, she had a small list, yogurt, toilet paper, and orange juice. Margaret added goldfish crackers, juice boxes, and oatmeal cookies. You can have these snacks when you return, Margaret told the two. Can we have Gatorade instead of juice? Darren asked. The list had become illegible, and by the time the two left to do the errands, Margaret wasn't sure what they would bring back with them. But within the hour, all three were seated at the table eating grapes, vanilla wafers, and pudding. They drank blue Gatorade straight out of the plastic bottles. Margaret watched Darren offer his last cookie to Sarah, and she tilted her head and smiled as she took it from him. Sarah scooted her chair closer to him, and Darren covered his face with his hands for a minute to regain his composure. Sweet gestures went on like that, and Margaret observed them with wonder. The next day, the door knocker tapped with short, distinct taps. Margaret answered the door with a wool shawl wrapped around her pajamas, and she wore big, puffy, bright red slippers. She had found them in a storage box. Kyle gave them to her as a Mother's Day present when he was 12 years old. He had said, Mom, I liked these. They look like cherries, and so reminded me of you. Why do cherries remind you of me? She had asked him. Remember last summer and we were on the beach at that ice cream place and you ordered us a sundae and there was a cherry on top and then the cherry fell on your shoe and you looked at me and laughed and then you ate it right off your shoe. That was so awesome, Mom. At the time, Margaret was moved to tears by the thought of being awesome in the eyes of her son. If only it could have stayed that easy as eating a cherry off your shoe. Now Yvonne stood in front of Margaret with a blank expression. Franklin has locked me out of the house. He was supposed to leave the key under the mat, but it's not there. Can I use the phone? Yvonne asked in her thick Slavic accent. But of course, Margaret gestured for Yvonne to come in, but Yvonne hesitated a brief moment, looking down at her feet and then at Margaret's. Yvonne wore brown clunky shoes and black opaque pantyhose. Margaret's red slippers looked like clown shoes. Huh, Yvonne grunted and then walked over to the phone. She spoke in a guttural, deep voice, and when she hung up the phone, she said, Franklin's on his way. Well, may I offer you a cup of tea? You can relax here while you wait for him. Margaret went to the kitchen and filled the teapot with water and placed it on the stove. Yvonne asked, Margaret, what can you tell me about Sarah? Her father and I have been worried. Has she told you anything? Margaret mulled over the predicament, how to be honest and yet not betray Sarah's confidence. She also knew that she couldn't let the secret romance go on for too long without a possible disastrous outcome. They were innocent, but their hormones were not. While thinking it through, she told Yvonne, she seems very happy, if that's your concern. Okay, good, but I get the feeling like she's hiding something. What has she told you? Sarah has a new friend. Isn't that wonderful, Yvonne? Margaret knew she'd have to divulge the truth right then or come up with a better plan. A new friend? Have you met this friend? Why wouldn't Sarah want to tell us that she has a friend? Yvonne sounded hurt, and for the first time, Margaret sensed her tough exterior soften. Why did she not want to share this with her own parents? This time, it was a personal question, not directed at Margaret. I just don't understand. I have an idea. Why don't you and Franklin and Sarah and her friend come here for dinner tomorrow night? The four of you can enjoy a nice romantic dinner. What do you mean romantic? Is her friend a boy? Yvonne stood up from the table and now looked directly at Margaret. Oh, that's just an expression. You know, it will be very intimate and friendly, that's all. Margaret took a deep breath. But since you asked, yes, her friend is a boy. Yvonne pulled her shoulders back and folded her arms. This is unacceptable. Sarah can't have a boyfriend. He's a very nice boy, Yvonne. They met at their school, Margaret explained. You met this boy and didn't tell us? Yvonne glared at Margaret. Margaret noticed the deep creases across Yvonne's forehead and her eyes became beady slits. Isn't it better that she confided in someone? Margaret was feeling defensive. She knew she had done her best to help. Last year, one of Sarah's girlfriends got pregnant. The parents didn't find out until she began to show, months into the pregnancy. What do you think would happen if Sarah became pregnant? Yvonne sat back down at the table and rested her head in her hands. Margaret sat next to her, and with some hesitation, she placed a hand on Yvonne's arm. Yvonne didn't jerk away, so Margaret scooted in closer. Margaret said, I'm sure it hasn't gone that far, Yvonne. They appear to be very innocent. Isn't it better to meet Darren and have some influence over the situation? Yvonne took a napkin from the holder and wiped tears from her eyes. She sighed heavily, and after a long moment, she said, we'll come for dinner. Margaret searched through her cookbooks for Slavic Jewish recipes. She looked over the ingredients for borscht, cabbage rolls, Hungarian goulash, and latkes. What would Darren like, she wondered. She finally decided on borscht and latkes for appetizer, baked fish and Russian salad with lots of mayonnaise. Darren would surely like that for an entree. She told the two lovebirds about the dinner invitation that morning, and although hesitant, they both gave in to the idea with Margaret's gentle encouragement. By the time the knocker tapped, announcing their guests, everything was ready. Margaret and Darren stood together at the door to welcome Yvonne, Franklin, and Sarah. Sarah stood behind her parents meekly, and when Yvonne and Franklin saw Darren, they passed right over him. They both glanced around and finally fixed their gaze on Darren. This is your friend, Sarah? Yvonne asked her daughter. Her tone wasn't angry, just surprised. Franklin shrugged his shoulders and shuffled his feet. I brought an apple kugel for dessert. Yvonne handed it over to Margaret. Franklin handed her a bottle, and this is honey wine from my country. That's so thoughtful. Well, now let's all move to the table, shall we? Margaret began nudging the tightly nestled yet awkward group. Four sat down heavily while Sarah kept her head down and eyes averted. Finally, Sarah said, Miss Margaret, where are you going to sit? How about if I squeeze in right here next to you? Sarah smiled. By the end of the evening, once her guests had shuffled out the door, Margaret was spent. She collapsed onto her bed, exhausted, but knowing it had been worthwhile. Margaret had successfully introduced Darren into the lives of the Ivanov family, and she felt the warmth of a big, ever-present love.
Coming up now, we have Good Vibrations by artist Nancy J. Fagan. This story looks at Fagan's experience in managing her rheumatoid arthritis. For those navigating their own conditions, they may find themselves relating to Fagan's experience.
Good Vibrations by Nancy J. Fagan. I wake at 3 a.m. in the morning or thereabouts. I know the general time because my neck is vibrating. Every night while I dream, my device fires during a randomized minute somewhere in those wee pre-dawn hours. If I sleep on my left side, the movement is startling and foreign, despite the many months the compact bullet of energy has rested deep against my vagal nerve, adjacent to my carotid artery. It doesn't wake me, that's my busy mind instead. My device, a vagal nerve stimulator, has released me from the throes of pharmacology costing thousands of dollars in medication each month, millions over a lifetime. More importantly, it has relaxed the grip rheumatoid arthritis has held on my life for over 30 years. Rheumatoid arthritis, or RA, affects over 1 million people in the United States alone. RA is not the same as osteoarthritis, which naturally occurs with age or after joint trauma. I get the confusion. They both cause joint pain and swelling. But RA brings a bonus. It is a disease that leaks from the joints through the body to the organs. It's autoimmunity at its finest, a body attacking itself in a fit of rage, leaving erosion in its wake. My husband's friend gave him an article about using vagal nerve stimulators as an experimental treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. The preliminary results were hopeful. "Read this," my husband urged, his voice filled with optimism, "something new." I rolled my eyes and scoffed. "Everyone has the thing that will cure me." I thought briefly about the pleas from well-meaning friends and family to try emu oil, gin-soaked raisins, or a line of natural products that would have cushioned my former dental hygienist's pockets with profits from their sales. I received a recommendation from a nurse practitioner to switch to organic meats. She had no idea that I had been vegetarian for nearly 50 years. I had, long before my husband came to me with the Heavily Thumb magazine, given up on miracles. "Read it, please." His tone was colored with the good, the bad, and the awfully ugly that over 40 years of marriage to a person with a chronic illness had brought. He'd seen me at my worst and suffered alongside. The least I could do was read about the treatment. The article drew me in immediately. It was printed in the magazine section of a well-known publication with science to back it up. I reached out to the company that manufactured the stimulators and corresponded with them for nearly 7 years, outlasting a variety of their staff members and physician leads who moved to other jobs or retirement. I decided to volunteer for their next clinical trial. But they needed funding and government approval, and I would have to qualify for the study, go off my effective biologic medications for months, and undergo neurosurgery. There was a 50-50 chance of sorting into the control group where I would not receive the therapeutic stimulation for the first 3-month phase of the trial. My mind tumbled with the decision. When the invitation to apply to the official clinical trial appeared in my inbox one day, I accepted. When you have a chronic disease that is hidden and you don't complain about it constantly, people assume you're fine. After 30 years of adjusting my life to suit the disease, people see the public me, not the patient. Not my early-to-bed days, afternoon naps, or the strain of folding laundry. They can't feel my ankles burning through the night despite medication and ice packs. No longer do I start the day at 5 a.m. in the gym for an hour on the stair stepper before a 12-hour nursing shift. Instead, I walk. I started slow, 5 steps, then 10, and a few more each day until I got to 100. I consistently go 1 mile now, at least on weekdays. I had tried one drug after another, and sometimes three at once for months, even years, until my team came up with an effective treatment that had tolerable side effects. One that allowed me to engage with the outside world. One that provided moderate relief and rest. The curated combination of drugs also gave me low platelets, dwindling white blood cells, and squamous cell skin cancer. And only the inner circle of someone with a forever illness sees the effect of its chronicity on a spouse, a dear friend, or a child. My body is hard to live with. I saw my mother in the operating room. She sat in the corner with a quirky smile on her face, like she had a secret to share. I felt her around and within me, and I knew I was safe because she was there amidst the noise of the instruments clinking together, the mask faces above, and the straps that secured my arms. She'd been dead 10 years, but her death did not stop my enhanced mind from imagining her. I wanted her there at my chance to rid myself of my pharmacy and to take a gamble that I might feel mostly whole again. As I was attacked from both sides by mumbling doctors, she perched on a stool overseeing the procedure. When I woke from the operation, my mother was gone. But her absence did not surprise me. The crisis of playing with my vagal nerve was over, with the device firmly stitched inside where it will stay for the rest of my life. I tuned into the recovery room, much like the one I used to work in before RA helped me leave my job. I understood the lingo, the procedures, the consciousness level of the patients. The normal buzz of conversation and its interruption by ringing phones and patient moans. I smelled the lick of anesthesia on my breath. I was certain I could taste it. Over the months of summertime, my dosages in the form of amperage instead of needles were adjusted. Frequent four-hour trips to the study center with my husband's chauffeur gave us time to discuss how I felt, though specifics were difficult to qualify and made me cranky. I told him instead how I wished to feel by the time the therapeutic dose reached its ceiling. With each visit, the nurse raised her iPad and controlled me, entering mysterious numbers, testing my blood and my heart. Pain resumed in small bursts and seared into my joints through June and July. My stiffness and fatigue threatened to overwhelm the way it had 30 years earlier when I begged my rheumatologist for relief. It was clear to me that I was sorted into the control group and was not receiving any stimulation. At any point, I could have exited the trial, but I reminded myself of the reasons I had chosen to participate. I wanted to avoid the ill effects of drugs. The major pharmaceuticals I took each week had been on the market for a mere 20 years, not enough time to predict its long-term effects on my body. What other not yet identified dangers would surface and threaten my future? In addition, as I neared Medicare age, my injectable drug cost out of pocket shifted astronomically. A change in drug regimen was planned, a pharmaceutical experiment that Medicare covered, thwarted when I signed the papers for the trial. Instead, my vagal nerve stimulator was gifted to me, endowed by generous benefactors who took a chance with their money instead of their bodies. The study paid my travel expenses and provided yarn money for my troubles. Above all, it carried a guarantee that after 3 months, when I entered phase two, the device would be fully activated to deliver its true therapeutic dosage, regulating my immune system through the vagal nerve, its manager. The fact of a fully functioning device, along with my study nurse's encouragement, came together as an acceptable risk, and I plodded on through days peppered with long naps and sighs. The second phase approached, the one where everyone vibrates. Over a few weeks, the true therapeutic buzz from the stimulator dampened my RA symptoms. It's remarkable, isn't it? I watch my rheumatologist pour over my hands, wrists, feet, and ankles. I have no swelling, no pain. He is cautious with praise. 6 months after going off my injectable for the trial, we decided to stop my other RA medicines. Within a year after entering phase two, the bottles of pills and capsules in my cupboard and the pre-filled syringes from my fridge were banished. No more increased risk of skin cancers, lymphoma, or the need for medication to work through my tired liver to allow me a day free of pain. Weeks of continued improvement ensued without the biweekly shots, pills, and steroid injections that I'd taken for decades. However, the damage that was done before persists in my wrists and hips, and on occasion, a finger joint will be tender or puffy. I'm realistic about the future. We're treading through territory that might have pitfalls, drawbacks, or a day when my stimulation is not enough to hold my disease in check. Today, post-implant, I work all day, full-time, at my hobby that is now my new profession as a writer. Though I take most of the credit, my device helped me complete graduate school and allowed the energy to publish essays and stories, plus find an agent for my debut novel. But the vagal nerve stimulator did not fix every issue. Aside from random joint tenderness, I also maintain a level of tiredness that supersedes the usual. I did not sleep well last night. It is bone fatigue, felt inside out, like the sense of one's cells dying or reorganizing to mount a revolt. One of the study doctors says fatigue is indicative of my disease activity. Rheumatoid arthritis is still bubbling beneath the surface of my skin, but it is no longer erupting. I also consider that my friends complain of tiredness too. So there is the possibility that something else comes along with being over 60. Last night, when I woke at 3 a.m. and felt the buzz, I held a mix of appreciation with an eerie feeling. It was deep night. The windows were covered in blackout drapes. My husband snored lightly beside me. There was a lump of cat at the bottom of the bed echoing his rumbles, while a piece of metal encased in plastic shuddered in my neck. In that moment, I wanted the device gone. Why couldn't I be well again without the extra metal inside? It's just too odd, too sci-fi. Then the vibration dissipated. It ebbed so quickly. I'm not sure I remembered what it felt like when it gave me a tune-up moments before. I stretched and wiggled my wrists, then my ankles, and slipped into a dream.
To round out this podcast, let's end on The Tree That Reminds Me by Rhonda Zimlick, which explores Zimlick's lifestyle as they do their best to live with a chronic disease. As she explores the world around her, she reflects on her own existence. Zimlick's story reminds us that just because we're in a battle, that doesn't mean you should give up the fight.
The Tree That Reminds Me by Rhonda Zimlick. The crisp fall air stung my right ear, reminding my left ear of its numbness. My legs begged to stretch. I drew circles in the air with my feet, awakening them to the coming task, and felt my ankles warm. This is how I prepared for my regular distance of 3 miles. I windmilled my arms and rolled my head and neck along my shoulders. My body begged to run. In went the earbuds to waves of something in the way she moves that stirred my feet with a slow rhythm and pulled me forward, a mere trot in the beginning. As I moved, I scanned my body, greeting the soles of my feet, feeling them kiss the earth with each step. Hello, I thought, to the swing of my arms. Each elbow pulled back in stride like a locomotive's rocker arms. My shoulders spread, and the breath in my lungs extended deeper and deeper expanding my ribs and bathing my heart in rich oxygen. This is the way the body works, I thought. During those early runs, I didn't have fatigue. I didn't have doubts. I didn't even have multiple sclerosis. I did, but it was easier to forget back then. I arrived in the run with my mind on my strength, observing my working form. As my legs pulled and pushed at the earth, my attention went outward to my surroundings. The route took me through my West Eugene neighborhood, past a collection of eclectic homes adorned with front yard gardens and Free Tibet flags. Rain had darkened the asphalt of the street and puddled the sidewalks, but let up for the morning. I could smell a storm distilling nearby, perhaps along the Coast Range, typical for Oregon. The soft gray sky hovered above. A pause in the music gave way to a shush of breeze described by the canopy of branches overhead, a standard refrain for autumn in the Pacific Northwest. Great trees framed the sidewalk. The neighborhood had yet to awaken as I stole away on my private endeavor, my solace those few miles of solitude. A quiet voice within me coaxed my body to keep moving in ways that most people do not, to get up and go, to run. The cool breath of morning filled my lungs, cold nipped my cheeks, and I ran like a Shakespearean angel, express and admirable, a miraculous feat which denied the disease in me. Early on, I ran for clarity and not speed, ever stretching my breath, emptying my thinking mind. I ran to feel the body of me, to become my physical self once more. I ran to outrun the encroaching numbness. For joy and breath and 100 different things I ran. Mostly I ran because I could. I crossed a narrow alleyway, then turned at Taylor Road. Cherry trees lined the sidewalks, shedding their leaves in the morning breeze. They cascaded like ticker tape, championing me on. Their falling beauty pulled me in, and at once I became a part of the show unfolding. This morning stage welcomed me to the scene. A cat waited on its porch, eager for access to its warm home. Pebbles filled the driveway, which led to a house adorned by Halloween decor. A silly witch stirred a cauldron. A ghost peered out the window frame. And now a great black bird moved from a wire to a branch, an effortless-looking motion that seemed more like a hop than flight. I envied its ease of movement. A lone car glided past, puffs of its white steam issuing complaints against the cold. I watched it turn the corner ahead, and then I was alone again. I turned left. The pavement turned to bark mulch. The music turned to a woman holding her tongue, knowing silence would speak for her. Steady, unlike my left hand when it trembled with nerve damage, I strode the length of the path. Rhythmic, unlike the courage I held against my fear, courage that wavered when my symptoms flared, I held my head high. Fast, so unlike my typical movements, carefully measured, clumsy despite my efforts, I flew, balanced, gliding through the morning, my mind along for the ride. My body surprised me, mocked the disease that threatened me, a silent and abiding menace. I came around the bending path through the trees, mist clinging to their roots. And then I saw the tree that reminds me. I see her still in my mind's eye, both harbinger and helper. If I close my eyes, I see the silhouette of her etched against the void. I almost forget her until I don't, until she comes to me or I to her. That day, I had returned. Since then, 1,000 times she's come to my memories, to my waking dreams. The tree stood at mile 2, a great and old maple. That time of the year, its leaves were all but gone, having drifted off to become the soil and other things. Yet even without her grand foliage. She reminded me of disease, with her exposed inner trunk stripped of its protective cambium layers, like delicate nerves stripped of their myelin. The scar along her neck laid plain the damage she knew, showed where the lightning had traveled as it attacked. The tree leaned in the direction of her injury, curled around the damage in its protective gesture. The mutilation along her trunk and bark, a telltale sign of how her life changed once the strike occurred. When lightning strikes from cloud to ground, a billion joules of energy detonate in a flash. The moment of detonation itself is significant. Energy always accompanies a time component. If that same billion joules of energy were spread across the lifetime of the tree, it would photosynthesize its entire livelihood. Instead, the abrupt discharge of energy ripped its bark from its trunk and laid open a vast wound. It seared her length, rendering a deep, interminable scar. Now as much a part of her as her canopy, branches, and roots. The attack, a singular event in her life, disease for me, recurring. The bark of my nerves, branches, myelin, had been struck by my own immune system. These attacks occurred many times and would occur again, myelin stripped and scarred. Without this protection, my nervous system sometimes short-circuited. Numbness crept up my limbs. The largest scar between my C3 and C4 vertebrae, the size of a dime. A dime. No other scar on my outside body was as large. Yet there I was running, working as properly as I ever had. And there she was too. That great maple squared off at me, upright and proud. She did not lay down after that lightning strike. Each spring she reawakened and filled her working branches with budding leaves. Each summer she turned sunlight into sugar deep within her mighty veins. Each fall she cast those leaves off again, contributing to the nutrients of the soil around her. She reminded me that morning, and every morning I passed her, that life persists. We make choices to ensure that it does. This life of mine moved me past the tree. By then, I felt tired. The tree had also reawakened a staggering memory of my limitations, of my body's own strike to attack itself, mistaking healthy tissue for disease. I rubbed the spot on the side of my thigh where I last injected my medication. A lingering pain and a lump under my skin hosted a spider-webbed contusion. The bruise benign and necessary, but reminding me nonetheless. By then I felt my heart thump in my chest, and I heard it as well, heard it over the song reverberating through a long fade out. By then I knew more about MS than many doctors. Each manifestation of disease, its minor and major difference for everyone, how it impacted me. By then the tree was behind me, though she remains with me still. Recent talks about trees include their cognitive ability to communicate in a language we cannot understand. I'm not sure I endorse this theory entirely. As humans, we are prone to anthropomorphize in order to assuage our own position in nature. But I do believe in the message I received from that tree. If cognizant of her own damage, she chose to persist. Even if not cognizant, she persists still. Whether I am thinking about the disease that ravages me or not, it's still there. And I can make the same choice to persist. How infinite in faculties, in form and movement, how express and admirable is the miracle of our bodies, is the miracle of the beauty of nature around us too, ever reminding us, ever teaching us. The final push moved me back to the pavement, through the neighborhood streets, down the familiar road where I lived. In the end, I had fatigue, but I ran anyway. I had doubts, but I pushed at them with each new stride. I had fear, but I pressed on. In the end, I finished the run, but it was my courage that won the day. That incessant competition between fear and faith that exists beyond my myelin. In the end, I pushed back at the disease. I could not allow MS to be a factor in the equation, or else it would have stopped me in my tracks. Thank you for listening. I wrote this piece, The Tree That Reminds Me, about 5 years after I had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. I had been taking an interferon-based medication that made me really sick. So 3 miles was about as far as I could run. Later, it became a formative piece in a blog I started for people with chronic illness and running, especially for people with MS. Now it serves as the opening for my memoir in progress about battling MS while also running 8 full marathons, including 1 ultra marathon. The book also addresses intergenerational trauma, alcoholism, grief, and the restorative intimacy of family. I hope to begin marketing the book later this year in 2024. Again, thank you so much for listening.
That concludes part 2 of the Kaleidoscope podcast for issue 88. Once again, I would like to thank every one of our contributors, for this would be impossible without them. Thank you for allowing us to share your voices and perspectives. I would also like to thank PNC Bank for sponsoring this podcast, and you, our listeners, who make this podcast possible. You can support Kaleidoscope Magazine and Podcast at udsakron.org/donate. Tune in next time as we uncover more experiences of disability through literature and the fine arts in our next episode.